Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchtereun, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the technocrats who tried to administer France after the Terror, the extraordinary attempt by the Fifth Crusade to conquer Egypt, and to end the show, the siege and fall of Constantinople in 1453. You can email us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. And we begin tonight's show with the desk revolutionaries who governed France between the Terror and the rise of Napoleon. This is a period of history that's often been dismissed as an unsuccessful interlude in the history of the French Revolution, but a new book argues that this overlooks the remarkable achievements of the technocrats who attempted to turn revolutionary ideals into functioning government and whose laws and institutions helped to shape modern France. The book is called Desk Revolutionaries, The Men of the French Directory, 1795 to 1799. It's published in hardback by Reaction Books. The author is Bianca Maria Fontana. And Bianca Maria, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
Can I begin with a question about running a government and running an efficient government? This book, and I suppose when we look at the world today, that is one of the great challenges. How do you run an effective government while still retaining a degree of popular support?
Yeah, in fact, that was, in a way, the original question that led me back to that particular historical experience. Of course, as a historian, I've been working on that period, so it was quite a natural response. But the problem of today's democracies seems to be, in fact, the relation between making some, let's say, technical choices about the economy, about the environment, about all sorts of things, about security, and the fact that you need people's support to do them because you are in a representative government. And I would say, actually, that today the gap between knowledge and public opinion is even greater because issues have become more complicated. 18th century governments could still rely on their own experts, so to speak. Today, they have to rely on non-elected bodies.
And the forgotten story of the Directory really helps us to understand how things operated 200 years ago when they faced similar challenges. And it's a period of history that is often overlooked. The attention is usually on the revolution itself from 1789 up to maybe the death of Robespierre in 1794. And then it continues with the rise to power of Napoleon in 1799. But this period in between often gets skipped over.
Yes, indeed. And this is, of course, one of the things that motivated me to do the book. In France in particular, and amongst French historians, the Directory has become a very ideological subject because, to put it very crudely, the left views it as the end of the betrayal, in fact, of the revolution, and it's sliding back into a bourgeois liberal republic, to use President Mao's definition. While, you know, the right views it as a government of ineffective bureaucrats compared to the glory of Napoleon and his military victories. If I can say something more personal, when I was a schoolgirl in Milan during the last century, so 100 years ago, the Italian television, that at the time had just one chain, produced a TV series called The Great Chameleons that covered exactly the period of the Directory and had the best Italian stage actors in this operation. And it was of an incredibly sophisticated sort of form that today would be unthinkable. And in a way, that story stayed with me ever since. I've always wished to go back to that particular. But I mean, this is not really very very serious motive. No, the motive is really to understand how from the French Revolution you go back to some form of normal regime, which is what, you know, these men were trying to do. I had also a sort of curiosity about how do people survive revolutions? You know, you've been caught into it, you're not an ideologist, you're not really militant, but you made it through it. And then, you know, what is your life like?
You mentioned there you describe them as bureaucrats. In the book, you even suggest that in modern jargon, they might be called technocrats. And it's interesting how we tend to focus on the charismatic leaders and figures rather than on these hardworking officials. They were lawyers and engineers and administrators, and they achieved quite a huge amount in terms of the fiscal system, in terms of rewriting the law and reshaping the army and putting in place many of the elements of the system that continued in the Napoleonic era and beyond.
Indeed. In fact, some of the institutions they created, like, I don't know, the Conseil d'État, are still ruling France today. Their fiscal reform lasted until 1914. The problem is that there is, even in France, I mean, France, since the revolution, has made a point of promoting to government people who come from special schools and have a special training, often at the expense of the Republic itself, you know, sort of French ideological infighting. And in a way, in some sense, in France, the French Revolution has never been over ideologically, to distinguish the elements that actually made the heritage of the revolution lasting and solid, because you can change a regime, go from the monarchy to the empire, or the empire to the republic, but you don't destroy a fiscal system that works. So that was partly, you know, the curiosity.
And it is fascinating the way the book isn't just about the achievements of the Directory, but how those achievements were subsequently remembered or perhaps not remembered, the way they were denied or ignored or twisted, that people didn't really want to give the Directory any credit.
Indeed. And this was partly because of the lack of, shall I say, heroic appeal of the directors, though some of them had a rather sort of good revolutionary record, like Lazare Carnot, who was a military man who saved the Republic during the war against the coalition at the very beginning of the Revolutionary Wars. But there was no charismatic figure, there was no specific appeal, and also these were not party men. I think this is quite important. I mean, France didn't have proper political parties, but there was a clear sort of stand, you know, you were a revolutionary or you were a royalist or something like that. This man belonged during the revolution to the center. That's another problem that brings us back to contemporary issues. They belonged to a sort of moderate majority of the assembly, were not especially committed to radical measure. And this also contributed to discredit them to some extent. You may be amused to know that the only existing government today, which is precisely modeled on the French Directory, is the government of the Swiss Confederation. Switzerland was occupied by France in 1798, and a directory was established there. Then it disappeared, and then it was revived in 1848 when Switzerland became a federal state. And in Switzerland, it works. You know, it's a collegial government, no prime minister, rotating presidency. But it works in Switzerland because there is a very strong republican tradition, a very tightly knit political elite, which obviously wasn't the case in France.
Can I ask a question about Napoleon? Because Napoleon always gets huge credit for his administrative, political, military reforms. And I'm wondering how much of that credit should go to the achievements of the Directory during this period?
Well, some of it certainly should go to them. But Napoleon was unquestionably very clever in his capacity to understand what advantage could be derived by this kind of skill. So in that sense, I think, you know, the great reforms of the consulate, you know, should keep their credit. It shouldn't be taken away from them. But he actually built on something that was there, and especially he built on a class, class is probably not the right term, but on a substantial group of middle-class, well-educated administrators that managed to make France possible to rule. And this is quite one of the big differences between the French Revolution and modern, I'm talking very crudely, of course, but modern revolutions, that in the end, power always remain in the hands of those who had been ruling the country beforehand. I mean, at the time, they were, you know, just subordinate to the monarchy, then they became subordinate to the empire. But there was a great continuity in the administrative class, which wasn't actually the case in, say, Russia or China.
Was the great mistake of these desk revolutionaries that they were governing effectively, but that in a democracy you also need to persuade people that what you're doing is legitimate and worthwhile, and they failed to make that argument?
Well, they were elected. I mean, the composition of the directory was that of a government represented the major, let's call them parties, but political currents present in France at the time. In that sense, the directory remained very dependent on the balance of power within the representative assemblies. This, incidentally, is also true during the revolution of the Committee of Public Safety. I mean, in France, there's never been, during the French Revolution, a very strong revolutionary leadership. And that was even more apparent during the directory. I mean, everything was dependent on elections and on popular consent, and this is why popular consent was so important. And as I say, these people did not, with some exception, maybe CIS, for example, did not really have the support of serious electoral constituency or something like that. So their position was always very fragile, and they could very easily be accused individually of all sorts of real or imagined misdeeds.
Can we look at some of their achievements then, maybe in the area of taxation or the law or the reform of the government ministries? How much of modern France can be traced back to the work of these people during this period?
Well, one important side concerns the actual structure of executive power. I mean, one of the immediate effects of the revolution was, out of suspicion of the king, of the monarchy, of its ministers and so on, was to wipe out basically everything that existed in that domain. So ministries had to be reconstructed, which means they had to be restaffed. And they had to be restaffed because before they were sort of sinecures, people who were not even paid but just sat there and so on. So there was a new recruitment of civil servants. And of course, if you start recruiting civil servants, you have to create competition to recruit them, and you have to create special school where they're going to be formed. So this has been a major first bit of the story. A sort of meritocratic system accessible to people from different social backgrounds, because there were scholarships, and to get into the ministries. Then there was the problem of, if you look at fiscality, everybody agreed that the Ancien Régime system of fiscality was very inefficient. This is perhaps is not widely known, but the French king did not collect his taxes. Taxes were basically subcontracted to private operators. And you can imagine the result of this thing. Now, if you want to set up a fiscal system, you need to know who the people are and who's going to pay your taxes and so on. So there was a big work that was introduced of social statistics. You know, departments were sent forms they had to fill to describe who was there, what they were doing, and so on. The famous Place des Vosges in Paris, one of the most elegant squares in Paris that was before had a name taken from royalty, was named Place des Vosges because the Department of the Vosges was the first department that sent back to Paris the result of their statistical investigation of fiscality. So there was a kind of prize. Then there were other domains that probably are less apparent. One important one was inland navigation. Which in France, as in England and everywhere in Europe, was very important at the time, but was blocked by all sorts of legal questions about right of passage, docks, and stuff like that. Then there were the first commercial exhibitions that were also started in this period, and all sorts of encouragements given to manufacture and commerce. So, you know, it's a, but looking back at the state, you ask what is still there. Well, I gave as example the Conseil d'État. One of the major problems at the end of the revolution was that, this probably will give you a general idea, about between sort of 30 and 40,000 laws voted by the Legislative Assembly had never been applied. And at some point, you know, the people just thought, well, they're not being applied because there's a resistance, they don't want to do it. But actually, they're not being applied because they just couldn't understand what they were about. So the Conseil d'État was created to provide a connection between legislative activity and the executive. It was a committee that, it is still a committee that, well, now it's become very much a sort of, to some extent, an honorary appointment, but basically it has to vet laws to see that they are actually applicable. Another gigantic domain, of course, is that of the law, because ancien regime legislation was naturally abolished during the revolution. But that meant they had to rewrite the penal code as well as the civil one. It was a major sort of work that was in fact only finished under Napoleon, under the consulate. But that again meant you had to restaff tribunals. Some of the directors wrote a kind of handbook for magistrates because magistrates couldn't find their way around the new legislation. So, you know, this is just to give you a few examples. There is, of course, also the domain of education, of schools, and creation of this special schools, high schools that are still a very important characteristic of the French sort of landscape.
Well, it's a very important new book. It's called Desk Revolutionaries, The Men of the French Directory, 1795 to 1799. It's published in hardback by Reaction Books. The author is Bianca Maria Fontana. And Bianca Maria, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Many thanks for your invitation.
We'll be back with the history of the Fifth Crusade and its attempts to conquer Egypt right after this break. Welcome back. We're talking history. In 1217, with Jerusalem still beyond Christian control, the leaders of the Fifth Crusade embarked on an audacious new strategy. Instead of attacking the Holy Land directly, they would invade Egypt and attempt to conquer the Nile Delta. What followed was a remarkable campaign of sieges, battles, new military technologies, and ultimately catastrophic miscalculation. And the story has been told now in a brilliant new book, The Fifth Crusade, A History of the Epic Campaign to Conquer Egypt. It's published in hardback by Yale University Press. The author is Thomas Smith. And Thomas, you're very welcome to the show.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, take us back to 1217 then. And the Fourth Crusade has failed. Jerusalem hasn't been recovered. And why did they come up with this audacious plan to set their sights on Egypt?
Yeah, I think when we think about Crusades, probably Egypt's not the first country that springs to mind in terms of the field of operations, but it's actually rooted in really good strategy. So after the Crusaders are pushed out of the Holy Land by Sultan Saladin in 1187, really they're left with a few toeholds in the Holy Land, but they've lost control of Jerusalem. And strategy then starts to change towards being able to hold Jerusalem long term. How can they get it back? How can they keep it in the long term? And they realize that actually Egypt is the main source of the Ayyubid Empire's wealth. It's because of the Nile flood. It is a really good place to grow grain. And so it's a very wealthy country and it can pay for the biggest army in the region. So the Crusader strategists have been thinking about this really for quite a long time, for decades, have thought that really what we need to do is we need to invade Egypt. We need to capture this part of the Ayyubid Empire. We need to take that wealth for ourselves. And then we can then take Jerusalem back. And then we'll have the money as well from those grain revenues, basically, to be able to pay for a big army and to hold on to it long term. So the whole pivot point of the board really in the Near East is Egypt.
Talk to me about what they discovered on their crusade then, and the monsters called crocodiles, because the crocodile almost became a symbol of what they found exotic, unusual, dangerous about this whole escapade.
I know exactly. This is what really drew me to the crusade in the first place, is the seeming incongruity of having crusaders, Knights Templar, fighting in the land of the pyramids. It seems really surprising, I think, and it's very, very different in terms of the theatre of operations they've been working in before. So they have to contend with a lot of new threats and dangers that they've never encountered before. The main one is crocodiles. So they've heard of crocodiles. They have these texts that circulate in the West. So they will have heard of them. They call them cockatrices in old French, but they've never actually seen them before. And we think then that probably some of the crusaders are actually eaten by crocodiles during the campaign. They certainly, the observers, leave these really vivid eyewitness descriptions of how crocodiles behave and how they were very terrified of the crocodiles because they eat their own young after they've hatched. So they're very worried about that. But there's other more mundane but equally deadly threats to deal with. So there's the threat of dysentery. A lot of the crusaders at the start, they drink the muddy, marshy, very fertile waters of the Nile. And actually this gives them dysentery. They die writhing in agony on the sands of the River Nile. You've also got the threat of flood as well. So the Nile Delta is a very peculiar place to be operating because of this annual flood. So this is very much amphibious siege warfare. The River Nile determines really the whole course of the campaign and its ending as well, ultimately. They're also facing as well, you know, a major military threat as well from the Ayyubid Empire. So they're facing off against someone called Sultan Al-Kamil, who's a very wily general. He's a very good strategist. And so he's trying to dislodge the crusaders from this region and get them out of Egypt as quickly as possible. So they're operating in an area, a region that's very exotic to them, very dangerous. And there's a very steep learning curve in terms of how to operate and survive in this region.
And when you describe the encounters, the battles and the deadly conflict and the fighting that ensues, the innovation that you see kind of on both sides, because the Crusaders face the equivalent of napalm, because it's this Greek fire being fired at them, a medieval version of a flamethrower or ceramic hand grenades, as you describe it, that there are these innovative tactics being used, and it is a time of new technologies.
Indeed. One of the things that's most exciting about this is that it really is a crucible for new military technologies on both sides. So on the Egyptian side, they make a lot of use of Greek fire. As you say, it's like medieval napalm. So the recipe for Greek fire famously has been lost, but we know that it's a naphtha-based chemical weapon that's very, very similar to modern napalm. So this is a flame-based weapon. So yeah, it's delivered in, we've got a 12th century depiction of a ship-mounted flamethrower that's being used in this region. So it could be used in that way. Also, you could deliver it more commonly, I think, in these ceramic hand grenades. So if you imagine like a large Christmas bauble that you'd put on your Christmas tree made of pottery, they'd fill this with Greek fire, set fire to it, then throw it, and this would explode. And this burns through anything that it touches. So the Crusaders have to come up with some pretty innovative ways of putting out these flames. You can't just douse them with water. So you need acidic liquids and gravel. So the only two liquids that are acidic enough are vinegar and stale urine. So I think when we think about crusading warfare, we might imagine that this is quite glamorous, chivalric warfare. This is really not on their ships. They've got, you know, huge vats of stinking urine sort of slopping around that some poor crusader is having to use to douse the flames and stop them burning through the ships. But then on the Crusader side as well, you've got some innovation there as well. So we see there's a very famous Frisian Crusader called Heo of Fivelgo, and we actually have a drawing of him holding what's effectively a medieval nunchuck. So this is an agricultural flail. It's two heavy wooden sticks tied together with a chain in the middle. And this is quite a fast operating, easy to handle weapon that's really good for storming cities. And Heo of Fivelgo is probably a pretty dangerous guy. He's modified this to make it even more deadly. He interweaves other iron chains as well. So it's really quite a fearsome weapon. And this really catches the eye of observers. It's written down, this is drawn. And then you've also got as well the invention of a unique floating siege engine. So there's a crusader on the Fifth Crusade called Oliver of Cologne. And he's a man out of place. He's a German schoolmaster who has recruited a lot of the people for the crusade and then joined the expedition. And they're trying to capture something called the Chain Tower in the middle of the River Nile. And they try pounding it with trebuchets. They even come up with an idea of trying to undermine it under the waters of the Nile, but they quickly give that up. But then he comes up with a solution. He invents this floating siege engine, which are two ships lashed together. They build a wooden fort on the top, and they put a rotating platform with a huge siege ladder on the front. And they use that to capture the Chain Tower. So we see actually this is a real crucible for the development of new technologies that are happening on the Crusade as it happens in a really kind of rapid and organic manner. It's really interesting.
Talk to me then about the Siege of Damietta, because the capture of that city seems to be one of the great victories of the Crusade, and it comes after one of the longest sieges in the history of the Crusades. Tell me about how difficult that was and how significant a capture it was.
Damietta was a really important city in the region. So it's one of the most important trade hubs in all of the Mediterranean. And this is something that I think a lot of people didn't realize, actually. New research based on network analysis shows that Damietta was really up there as one of the most important ports. The reason why it's little known is because in the intervening 8 centuries, the Nile has silted, so it doesn't have its position on the coastline anymore, the modern city of Damietta. But also the medieval city is actually destroyed. So later after the Fifth Crusade, the Ayyubids realized they have to destroy this city to stop the Crusaders targeting it again. So it, you know, sort of fell out of use and became a non-entity. So we don't really recognize the city as being synonymous with a city like Alexandria, which is really its equivalent. Damietta's got about 20,000 souls living inside the city. This is a major medieval settlement. It's got a triple ring of walls, each higher than the last. So if you imagine modern three-tiered wedding cake, it looks something like that. We have a contemporary drawing of the city that shows it in that way. So this is a major defensive structure. It's a major city and it's a major trade hub. So this is a really glittering prize if the Crusaders can capture it. And they do manage to capture it, as you said, after one of the longest sieges of the history of the Crusades, and really one of the last great untold stories of the Crusades. So they besieged the city for 18 months, and finally they crack it through the weapon of starvation. So they managed to enact a strict blockade around the city, and effectively they starve the city into submission. It's really quite a gruesome sight. When the Crusaders finally capture the city on the 5th of November 1219, they send a crack squad of soldiers to burn through one of the outside gates, and then they lift their ladders up to the second wall. And the sight that greets them is almost apocalyptic. They see dead bodies lying in the streets. They're really moving depictions of what's inside the city, of parents having died and their children having died in the same room, and they're unable to bury each other. It's a really, really gruesome sight and the result of this weapon of starvation, but it's very effective. And capturing Damietta means that the Crusaders have captured the first major Muslim city on a general crusade since Jerusalem by the First Crusade in 1099. And they're actually starting to carve out a brand new crusader state in the Near East, so a new crusader state in Egypt. So this completely opens up the board in terms of the geopolitical situation. And it really is a game changer in terms of the history of the Crusades and a really glittering prize for the Crusaders.
And a wandering Italian friar, Francis of Assisi, turns up as well, which is an extraordinary cameo as well.
Yeah, it's quite the cameo. So he turns up. So everyone else has gone on this crusade to try and win the Holy War through fighting and siege warfare, and he turns up trying to end it through peaceful means. So he goes, but he begs firstly to go over to the Muslim lines and to try and preach Christianity to sold an Al Camillo. And the other crusaders say this is a suicide mission. Like, you can't go over the lines and try and do this. But I think he basically badgers them until they just relent and say, okay, just go. And they don't expect him to come back at all. We have other accounts from North Africa of other Franciscan martyrs being killed around this time. So it's a pretty brave thing to go over there and try and preach Christianity to the Sultan. And the Muslims think that he is actually there as to negotiate a truce, basically. So they let him into the camp of the Sultan, and they don't understand why he's there. And when they realize why he's there, suddenly the mood turns, and some of the Sultan's emirs want to have him beheaded immediately for the insult. But actually, Sultan Al-Kamil, he really emerges from the Crusade as its great hero. He's a real paragon of chivalry. He treats the Crusaders really generously every time he comes into diplomatic contact with them. And actually, he listens to what Francis has to say, and instead of having him killed, he actually sends him back with gifts of food and sends him back to the Crusader lines. And I think no one had expected him to return, so they're quite flabbergasted that he comes back. So he was unsuccessful in his mission of peace, but ultimately this is one of the first key moments in the foundation of the Franciscan order.
Everything seems to go crucially wrong then after the capture. There is a terrible inertia, as you describe it. There's drunkenness, there's theft and destruction. And then the role of the king, King John, as well, seems to be crucially important, that he had given his oath, that his word, that he wouldn't abandon the mission. But then he does just that. And everything kind of seems to fall apart for the Crusaders.
Yeah, so after they capture Damietta, this is a game-changing moment. But then, unfortunately for the Crusaders, they squander this. So they have a period of inaction and inertia that's really led by the fact that there's no main undisputed leader of the Crusade in Egypt. So they're waiting for someone called Frederick II, who is a really famous medieval emperor of Germany. He's taken the cross in 1215 at Aachen and promised to go on crusade, but he never actually leaves on the expedition. But it leaves the Crusaders in limbo. They're expecting him to arrive, and they don't want to march into the Egyptian interior until he comes. He's also trying to sort of control the crusade from a distance. So he's sending ambassadors, he's sending letters saying, you know, this is what you should do, don't make peaces, and so on. So they're waiting for him. But John of Brienne, also, his position is quite uncertain. So he's only king of Jerusalem through marriage, and his wife has died by this stage, and then he's only king now because he's looking after the rights of his daughter. But once she comes of age and marries, then he'll be redundant and he's going to be pushed out. So he's looking for opportunities elsewhere. He sees the Crusade as a way maybe to enhance his authority, but he's also looking for a crown somewhere else, and an opportunity comes up in Armenia, Cilician Armenia. And so he actually leaves the Crusade to try and pursue his claim there, and it fails. But all of this leads to a real sense of inertia. The Crusaders are not really able to progress towards their aim. And you've also got a system which is really changing the nature of crusading warfare in the East. So because they're besieging a port city, you've got reinforcements arriving all the time via two Mediterranean passages across the sea. But they're also taking people away. So people are starting to campaign for a shorter time. On previous crusades, most crusaders would have stayed until they die or until the end of the crusade if they survive, if they're one of the lucky ones. But actually on this crusade, what people start to do is there's a shift in the culture, and people start to campaign for about a year before they think that their vow has been completed, they've got remission of sins, then they go back. So actually all of these things together, this cocktail of ingredients, really hamstrings the crusade, unfortunately, for the crusaders.
And as you describe it, it's snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, because it turns what could have been a great achievement into a disaster.
Totally. So they've got everything. Damietta is the main achievement. This is a great city. There is great celebration as a result of them capturing this. But then they decide finally to march south towards Cairo. That had been the plan. And we can only understand why they do what they do if we factor in the power of prophecy. So on this crusade, the main thing that dictated the whole course of it was the River Nile. And the crusaders know that the Nile floods every year. They knew this before they went on crusade from their book learning. They knew it from, you know, some of them had experience of this, but they've also experienced it themselves now. They've been in Egypt now for several years, and they've seen how the Nile works every year, and they write about this in their chronicles and letters that it floods every year. They decide finally to march out south towards Cairo just as the Nile is about to flood in the summer of 1221. This is the worst possible time to be operating on the River Nile. So why do they do this? Well, the main reason, I think, is that actually they believe so much in prophecies that they decide that they need to go out at this time. So they encounter something called the Book of Clement, and this foretells that the Crusaders will capture Damietta, they'll capture Egypt, and then they'll capture Jerusalem, and that two Christian emperors will meet in a recovered Jerusalem, and that this will bring about the second coming of Christ and the apocalypse. And this is going to happen in 1222. So they realize then, well, we have to take Cairo now in the summer of 1221 to be able to bring about the second coming of Christ in 1222. So they believe that despite the floodwaters, that it's all going to work out for them. But of course, we know this isn't the case. They march south from Damietta, from the safety of Damietta. They make their way about almost halfway towards Cairo, and then they get flooded out basically by the Nile. They get surrounded by Sultan Al-Kamil's troops, and he does some pretty wily tactics here. So he opens the sluice gates to the fields around the Crusaders' position and floods them out even more. And the Crusaders realize now that they're really stuck. They're surrounded. They have to try and make it back to Damietta, and they decide on a covert night withdrawal. Now, the big problem is that the Crusaders have a massive drinking session the day before this. They've got large stores of wine, which they don't want to leave behind. And so the day before they withdraw, a lot of the Crusaders spend most of the day drinking. And by the evening, when they're supposed to do their withdrawal, you know, they're pretty sozzled, and they set fire to their own tents in the night. And when Sultan Al-Kamil sees the embers rising up into the night sky, he knows what's happening, and he falls upon them and basically fights them to a standstill. And then they negotiate a truce to save their lives, and they return Damietta to Al-Kamil in exchange for their lives. And this really is a source of major controversy in the West. The people have supported this. And the Crusaders had this great prize of Damietta. They should have just held on to that. That would have been a major achievement. But as you say, they snatched defeat from the jaws of victory at the very end.
And it becomes almost like the fall of Saigon in Vietnam, that there is all this panic and there's all this upset afterwards. And the focus of the Crusade seems to shift then. It seems to shift towards Jerusalem again, and it opens up a new chapter in the story.
It does, totally. So we see then some Crusades then go to Jerusalem, and they think that the Egyptian strategy won't work. We see other ones that copy the strategy of the Fifth Crusade, almost step by step. So there's a crusade by Louis IX in the middle of the 13th century, and he does exactly the same things as the Fifth Crusade. So he invades the Nile Delta, he captures Damietta, he marches south towards Cairo and gets defeated at basically exactly the same place, at somewhere called Mansoura, which is on the way to Cairo. So it does shift the axis of holy war in the region. We see another crusade as well in the 14th century, the Alexandria Crusade of 1365. So as I mentioned earlier, Damietta is actually destroyed by the Ibids after they realize that the crusade is going to keep targeting it and it's a weak spot. So they destroy Damietta and they move their trade operations to Alexandria. So in the 14th century, the Crusaders can't target Damietta anymore because there isn't anything left. So they target Alexandria instead in a failed crusade of 1365. So I think what it does is it really shifts the axis of warfare in the region. It really confirms that actually the Egyptian strategy was the correct one, despite the fact that it fails at the very end. Everything up until that point had been a major success. So it really does shift the axis of crusading warfare for a couple of centuries.
The book is called The Fifth Crusade, A History of the Epic Campaign to Conquer Egypt. It's published in hardback by Yale University Press. The author is Thomas Smith. And Thomas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back when we explore the siege and fall of Constantinople right after this. Welcome back. We're talking history. On the 29th of May, 1453, Constantinople fell to the forces of the Ottoman Sultan, bringing to an end an empire whose history stretched back more than 1,000 years, and in a very real sense, marking the final end of the Roman Empire. However, a major new account of the siege challenges one of our most basic assumptions about it, that the fall of Constantinople was inevitable. The book is called 1453, The Conquest and Tragedy of Constantinople. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press. The author is Anthony Caldelis. And Anthony, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you for having me on.
Can we begin with a question about terminology? Because usually, I suppose, when people talk about this period, they talk about the Byzantine Empire. But you say that actually the people viewed themselves as Romans, so we should really see this as the Roman Empire.
Well, they did view themselves as Romans, and that is what they call their state, the polity of the Romans, the kingdom of the Romans, Romania, which means Roman land. The Greek perception is a Western perception, so it is Western Europeans who had been calling them Greeks so as not to call them Romans for quite a few centuries. And modern historians have invented the term Byzantine by which to call them. That term has been current for a few centuries. It didn't really become established until the late 19th century. So if I had to pick between which term to use, the term used by the people in question, the term used by Western Europeans, or the term used by modern scholars, I will go with the first one.
So let's talk about the siege and how long it went on for. And I suppose really Constantinople itself, it was an enormous danger, but its fall wasn't inevitable, because even if we just look at the ancient walls, there's a formidable defensive system there, even in the age of gunpowder.
Yes, that's right. Now, when we say it's not inevitable, at least I mean it wasn't inevitable in 1453. There are various, hypothetical sort of contingencies you can imagine by which the city could have survived as a free Christian city for a few more decades, perhaps, under a different arrangement with the Ottomans, maybe longer. But my concern is specifically with the siege in 1453. And it was a very close-run thing. The walls of Constantinople, which were formidable, were 1,000 years old, and they were not built to withstand cannon, but they did for, 53, 54 days, depending on how you count it. My reconstruction of the siege is that the Sultan won decisively, but it was a much more stressful experience for him than most histories will give the impression.
And he was able to put together an incredible, strategy for it, because people thought that this might be an impregnable defense, but he was ingenious, he was tenacious, and he was able to find ways of breaking it down.
Yes, well, the one advantage that he really had were numbers of soldiers and the cannons. Because this was a siege, his cavalry was neutralized, and also the Christians were supreme in naval forces, and so he couldn't realistically attack the city by the sea, and that the city's surrounded by sea on three sides, right? So each side had advantages. The main strategy that he employed, which was successful in the end, was to force the defenders to spread themselves out. That is, to have to pay attention to other sectors of the defense apart from the main critical area in the land wall, so that when in the end he concentrated all of his forces there, there would be fewer defenders. And that is indeed what happened. So he really played to his strengths.
So talk to me about the people then in Constantinople. It does seem to have a mixture of different people. There were Turks, there were Italians, there were Romans, there were people of all different kinds of backgrounds.
Sure. So the population of the city was primarily Roman or Greek speaking. There were also very many Italians. They had trading colonies there. The Genoese had a whole essentially independent city just north of Constantinople. This was essentially neutral during the war, but they were mostly helping the Christians. So the Italians fall into two groups, the Genoese and the Venetians. Genoese and Venetians traditionally don't like each other, but all of these people pulled together, so the Romans, the Venetians, and the Genoese, to defend the city against the Sultan. While there sometimes was a Turkish presence in the city, for trade, for diplomacy, for study, for all kinds of reasons, once the war started, there was kind of a division by religion. The Sultan had some Christian forces too. Some Serbians. They later claimed that they played no part in taking the city. This was a very mixed area of the world in terms of languages, in terms of religions and economies. All of these people knew each other very well. They had been trading and dealing and fighting for decades, if not centuries. So this was a very long established mixed situation.
There was a blockade as well, and a blockade that they were able to break on some occasions to bring ships in.
Are you referring to the blockade of Bayezid, previous sultan? The Sultan Mehmed II also blockaded the city. This is essential, because if the defenders can keep bringing in supplies and reinforcements, you're never going to get anywhere. But it's important to mention the earlier blockade, because this is a prior sultan some 50 years earlier who had tried to take the city essentially through blockade, not so much through storming the walls or anything like that. And he almost won. There's some indications that they were ready to surrender after 8 years of starvation. But it just so happens, random fluke of history, that Bayezid was defeated by a Central Asian warlord called Timur or Tamerlane, who was just passing through. And that ended that blockade. But the history of Constantinople and of the Eastern Roman Empire could very well have ended 50 years earlier. Mehmed tried to blockade the city too, precisely so that reinforcements and supplies couldn't get in, but it wasn't very effective. Four galleys who came in late April, they managed to break through his blockade and enter the city. As I said, the Christians had naval superiority. The Ottoman fleet couldn't effectively harm them in the end.
This is an international story as well, because there were attempts by Constantinople to gain support from other parts of Europe. And you see an emissary from the Pope as well being sent. And there were attempts to draw in wider support, but that proved difficult because of other conflicts and other issues happening elsewhere.
Yes. So this is another very long-standing story. So Eastern Christians, today we call Orthodox Church, the Church of Constantinople, had been in negotiations with the Western Church, that is the Church of Rome or the Catholic Church, to unite somehow, to recognize each other again. But there are insurmountable obstacles to that. There still are. So the best that they could do is to kind of agree to, certain practices of common communion, maybe recognizing each other in some way, more civil discussion, but a true union lay beyond reach. And this created this very tension where, like, the West would say, the Pope would say, okay, first you convert to Catholicism, recognize my authority over you, and then we will send help. And the Easterners thought, well, maybe first you should send help, and then maybe we'll think about submitting to the Pope. And this is how it played out for centuries. So there would be a dribble of help, there would be a dribble of recognition of the Western Church. And in the end, that just proved to be too dysfunctional for effective aid to come in. Now, that's looking at the Pope. There's another party who could very well have sent aid and should have sent aid, and this was Venice. Venice had vital interests in the region, and had they acted faster, they could have shored those up. They could have preserved that and not have had to wage decades of war against the Ottoman Empire in the centuries to come, which they lost. So had Venice acted faster, sent a few more ships in time, Constantinople would have been saved, absolutely.
So what happened in the end? Why did the city fall? And is it that the defenders just ran out of what? They ran out of options? They ran out of materials? Were they just overwhelmed by the numbers? Why did it fall ultimately?
In my analysis, they just weren't enough of them. So they were really relying on the walls and the advantage that gave them in terms of tactical engagements, on site. But when you have fewer people, you are more vulnerable to risk and accident. This is something that we have all learned, for example, during the pandemic, right? That the same event can impact you differently depending on how many redundancies you have, right? How much backup you have, how robust your systems and chains of supply are, and so forth. And so when you have fewer people, an accident, and in this particular case, the accident was the fatal wounding of the Genoese commander on the land wall side, that caused a disruption among the defenders that led to a panic and a flight and chaos, and the Turkish soldiers took advantage of that. Of course, that's what they were hoping for. If you had more defenders, if you had some more backup commanders, you have Venetian reinforcements, as I mentioned, then that one accident would not have had that kind of impact. So I think that there just weren't enough defenders. We're talking about a difference of between maybe 8,000 or 9,000 on the defense side, for a city of that size, and maybe 60,000 to 80,000 on the other side. And so it's quite imbalanced. Had there been more defenders, especially actually trained fighters, I don't think it would have taken that many. Like, I think a few hundred would have made a difference.
Tell me what happened then after the fall of Constantinople, because you do talk about how the conquering army usually enriched itself by plundering the lands, taking captives for sale into slavery. And we see all of that. We see some escaping, some doing deals, but we do see many being captured and sold into slavery.
Yes, that's right. So this is a part of the story that surprised me the most. When people think about the capture of Constantinople, they think of the Ottoman armies moving into the city, occupying it, and it then becomes a Ottoman capital, and its career as the capital of the Ottoman Empire begins. But that's not what happened. What happened was that the entire population of the city was enslaved on that day. By nightfall, I think they had all been rounded up and removed from the city. They were taken to the slave camps outside the walls and to the Ottoman fleet, which entered the harbor once the few Christian ships that were there escaped. And so that means that by the end of that day, Constantinople was a ghost town. There might have been a few garrisons, sure, some Turkish soldiers still looking for the scraps. The population was not that large, something between maybe 35 and 50,000 people, which means it was smaller than the actual Ottoman army. And they were removed and dispersed across the empire. So Constantinople was essentially emptied out. I believe that its history as a Roman city, a Christian capital, ends. And it restarts very slowly with efforts by Mehmet to repopulate it. But those start a bit later. He wasn't sure what to do with the place, it seems, for a while. And he doesn't signal his intention to relocate there and use it as a kind of capital until 4 years later. So this is a real pause. The population was enslaved because the Ottoman army traditionally very good at two things. It was very good at defeating enemies in battle and rounding up slaves for sale on the slave market, part of which was run by Venetians and Genoese. So there's a whole story to be told about the captives and their fate. And I tried to tell some of those stories in the chapter After the Fall. That's a whole fascinating part of the story, like who gets to be ransomed? How do you organize something like that? But that was the main form of suffering experienced by the survivors.
And this did mark the end then, the final end of the Roman Empire?
Yes. I mean, there were some other bits here and there that survived for just a few years longer. There was the Roman state of Trebizond. This is in northeastern Turkey. So Trebizond is a city there. That had been the capital of a sort of kind of splinter Roman state for a while. There were some territories in the Peloponnese that survived for a while, not trying to reconstitute the Basileia, the kingdom, the empire of the Romans in any sort of meaningful way. So these were kind of mopping up operations for the Sultan after that. So yeah, 1453 is a pretty good date, both real and symbolic, for the end of the Roman Empire in the East.
Well, the book is called 1453, The Conquest and Tragedy of Constantinople. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press. The author is Anthony Kaldzelis. And Anthony, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Maurice O'Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so if you can join us then, we've been Talking History. Good night.